Everything that Jeff says. Okay, call to order regular meeting, public workshop, Northland Planning Commission, Thursday, April 12th, 2012, at City Hall. Before we go over the minutes, I just want to mention I'm not feeling terribly great. Stay away from the enemy.
At some point,
a little late to share that, don't you think?
Yeah, so I wanted to make sure.
I almost was going to shake your hand, but something told me.
Okay, minutes March 22nd, 2012 Planning Commission meeting. Motion to approve.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Questions, comments, corrections? All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries. Public comment on non-agenda items. Is there anyone here not coming for the Energy and Sustainability Workshop? Great. Right. Energy and Sustainability Workshop. As Mike's noted in the agenda, is first in a series. This one is concentrated on fossil fuel, electrical energy, use of conservation. Ron, you, before we go into that, though, you wanted to make some comments.
Yeah, I just wanted to. I'm stopping over here just for 5 minutes and wanted to just go over these graphs that I sent to everybody. I guess it was in the back there, right? Okay. Just wanted to give you an interpretation of it. And this is what we did. It was we put the counters out on 468th again, the same place where we had them last time, just south of North Bend Way, in between North Bend Way and the on-ramps to the freeway. And the first one, which is the 468th Avenue Southeast average traffic volumes, pretty much mirrors the last ones that we took back in November. There was some concern that maybe the November ones weren't quite right because it was holiday season. Well, they're about the same. Not much difference. Looking beyond that for weekday traffic volumes, I put on here the November one. And weekday traffic volumes, the March one. So we got two of them for me. One for November, one for March. Again, pretty much same type of pattern. The volumes are about the same, not much difference in volumes. Again, the very peak coming during school, or the people dropping kids off at school and at what time? 7 o'clock in the morning. And so again, not much change.
Are all of the graphs the same data set, November 29th, December 3rd, March 27th? Assuming that there wasn't too much 27th, I don't know which was, since I didn't look up Tuesday and Saturday yet, both later.
Which one are you looking at?
I'm on weekday versus weekend.
Okay, weekday versus weekend.
The first part of my question was, it says no. The other tables are labeled November and March, but not the dates. Are all of these the same date?
Yes. What I did was for ones that are just labeled for a month, I took a particular day, like a Tuesday, for November and a Tuesday for March, and so I compared same day. Same type of volume, whatever. The only, this initial one that's on the top of your list, that is the average for the entire 14-day period. And for both events, the March and the November, these are the averages.
So we counted for 14 days?
Counters were out for 14 days.
Okay.
Run to this peak in the morning, and I totally get the traffic to school. It's also returning from school. That vehicle drops off and then returns, right?
That's correct.
So that's, well, that's part of the tally of trip.
It's part of the trips, yeah. They might go northbound to the school and then come back southbound.
Right.
Some of them could go on 140th to North Bend, too. You know, hard to say where they're really going, but yeah. You can see that at least the pattern doesn't change.
Yeah. And then I'm just making sure I'm using good logic. If they didn't return, and they just went out en masse at 6:55 and 7:02 or whatever, then that peak wouldn't be there. It would be more of a gentle arc.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm guessing that that peak is because they are going out and back.
Yeah. In essence, doubling the trips.
Right.
Quickly.
Right. Let's see. Okay, the last ones are weekday traffic, cars versus trucks, for either November or March. And there's a little variation in there, but not significantly much. The cars do peak in the afternoon if you don't take into consideration the school, and the trucks are generally, you know, sort of a smooth curve throughout the day in both cases. Interestingly, we took a look at the number of cars versus the number of trucks, and the trucks made up about 48% of the traffic for the entire day.
And trucks, I'm assuming all of this counted in trucks would be service.
No. It's anything beyond two axles, a two-axle vehicle. So it would be three-axle vehicles or more.
So, Ron, I want to thank you for going out and rechecking the data in this area. But I have a question. I don't know if it would be a better benefit to the city if we also had a different location to study in the future, because especially with the school growth and whatever happens on Middleport Road, I notice more traffic going to Southeast 140th than I do coming onto the interstate. And I know a lot of the residents like myself actually try and avoid exit 34 and go to exit 32, or are going on Highway 202 depending on where their location is. So I'm just wondering, in the future, now that that's part of the city, if there might be a better or an additional location that we could study.
Well, there's not a better location. It's just that we'd be studying a different situation. So
yeah.
We can do it wherever you want. It's whatever your interest is or concern is, we can go and figure out what it is. If we want to figure out how much traffic is on Middle Fork Road, put a counter out there between the intersection and the school and see how much traffic goes there.
I'm just wondering if that might actually be a good way to get at least some baseline data so we know 7 years from now what the growth is.
What you were saying, Gary, was you're feeling that you're seeing a pattern. You're presuming that there's more folks going down 140th toward North Bend,
yeah,
versus coming out to the freeway or at least past.
So normally, I'm here a bit earlier, and I actually pulled over to the road and I counted 12 cars going on Southeast 140th and 2 cars going Edgewick or
468.
It's not scientific. I'm just saying, perception-wise,
right.
I see a lot more going that way, even just from a school event night. So the traffic might be coming more from that direction. I followed the stream down into North Bend and turned off the 436.
Yeah, our count location, you're saying it's between North Bend Way and the intersection, right? So what we've counted here is really interstate,
yep,
truck-related traffic.
Or people from the south side of the freeway coming up.
Yep.
Yeah.
That goes against the
It was basically
traffic, school traffic, that kind of.
I'm sorry.
If the counter location is somewhere here, right between 144 and 146.
No, it's down further south.
Further south.
Further south.
It's below.
Right. No, no. Up, 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 up. Just south of North Bend Lake.
Right
there. Yeah.
It's right about there.
Okay.
Sorry.
So if someone's traveling to school from town to this point, they're turning left. Are you making that up?
Yeah, they don't get counted.
It's not in these counts.
It's not. It won't be in the count.
Because this was originally oriented toward understanding the truck traffic.
Yeah.
Correct. Right. So figure out how much volume of trucks we're getting into truck town, its relationship to everything else.
And this was in comparison to the previous study, which makes sense to have it in the same location.
I'm just wondering
whether now we get a baseline or in the future study we look at a different location.
Yeah.
We talked about that, I think, when we initially did the where the counter was. I think I had asked a similar question. It was like, well, we put it there because we were trying to get the freeway traffic, but I agree with Gary that we probably need to get something else that really...
Whatever you want to focus on.
You know, defines what that school traffic is or other traffic on the floor.
So if you want to figure out how much school traffic is, or if you want to figure out how much traffic is coming from Middle Fork Road, or whatever, you know,
it's going to base a lot on what is it that we're trying to understand.
That's correct.
In its application.
And so, that's where every time we get more one data point, we figure out there's others we don't have.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to go down the speck on a white wall story, but the car traffic, intuitively, I'm thinking that that's the peak because of school. But where the traffic counter is, this peak suggests that traffic, if it's school traffic, they're coming off the freeway.
No.
If you're going to school, and you cross over the counter at that point, you've come from the freeway.
Or from the south side of the freeway.
Yeah.
Which, there's not that many people.
Or even if you're again, it's all speculation, but if I'm the person dropping off at the middle school, now I'm on the way to work, I might have come up North Bend Way,
right.
And now I'm getting the freeway.
You're going the freeway, which there's still quite a few.
So, just, again, it goes back to what are we trying to gauge?
The peak car traffic.
This was about getting to trucks.
Yeah. Right? I'm just clarifying, too, the peak point of traffic of cars. Yeah. So I think we're making a mistake if I assume those cars are school.
It's all school.
Right. Yeah. I don't think they're school as much as I initially thought. Given where the counter's located.
It could also just be people heading out to work.
Could be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or into work.
Yep.
Everybody from Wood River.
Yep.
Saying to go to work.
Yep.
7 o'clock in the morning.
You'd be surprised how many people don't go that way.
So we'll study Wood River. We'll put counters all around that thing, and we'll figure out where they're going.
So what you're telling us, though, in a nutshell, is that overall, statistically, about the same.
Yeah. That the numbers were verified in two different studies. They both comparably came up to about the same thing. And so our numbers are good in that respect.
Okay. Okay. So then when the transportation element comes back in two meetings, then we'll also have some relationship between our data and other data that was submitted, or some comment to that.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. We'll use this as a basis for reviewing some of their charts or whatever, and see what they're saying. It may be that their truck volumes in the comp plan are a bit too high. I don't know.
I assume Chris is evaluating all that data.
No, I'm evaluating all that data. Yes. Independent eyes on this thing. So, but that's all I had to say right now. So I thought I'd let you go on to bigger and better things.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Okay, Mike, I'm assuming you're probably going to want to give us a little bit of an overview of
first. I want to say to the folks in the audience, and for any of you that came a few meetings ago when we had had a notice out, apologize again and kind of brought you here under false pretenses. Appreciate you coming back.
Mike? So I thank everybody again for coming, for sacrificing. It's a pretty nice evening out there. So wanted to give just a brief overview of what it is that we're doing, what we're hoping to get out of this workshop, as well as the series of workshops that we have. We're going to have at the first Planning Commission meeting of each month for the next 3 months a focus on an aspect of sustainability. So we're developing the sustainability element of our comprehensive plan, and started out a couple months back, actually back in October, and the Planning Commission with a draft which we have on the city's website, and the Planning Commission asked us to step back and to take each particular component of sustainability and put it into a workshop so that we can get public input and we can look at some of the issues a little bit more in depth and consider whether the policies that we proposed are appropriate for North Bend and for the context of future development and the city's own operations as well. So I wanted to go back. Some of this we gave as an introduction at the first sustainability workshop, but I wanted to go back just to touch on some of the bigger highlights. First of all, what is sustainability? What is it that we're talking about tonight? And that's just the idea that we're passing along to our future generations the same or a better life as what we've had. And our focus on sustainability is not just an environmental focus. We're focusing on economic sustainability and social sustainability as well. And in North Bend in particular, I think that economic sustainability is very important. We're a small city, we have limited resources, so we're not looking to do any grand green plans. We're trying to do incremental, pragmatic actions. So why are we doing this in the first place? First of all, there's a number of state requirements, in particular grant funding eligibility. The second one there, RCW 70-235-070, established that state agencies that give out competitive grants, so these are some of our big sources of funding to North Bend, our Transportation Improvement Board grant, Department of Ecology grants, any state agency who's giving out grant funds for whatever project has to consider whether the particular agency has policies in place that address greenhouse gas emissions. So we have, for instance, our sidewalk improvement project that we just got a grant for this year. We've got a grant in progress for some improvements over our wastewater treatment plant. All of these projects are going to be dependent on having permanent policies in place, so it's important for our future funding situation. Also, electrification. We've addressed this already. The Planning Commission last year put into place some policies supporting development of private infrastructure, such as at gas stations or other charging stations, making sure that we're compatible with policies statewide and for a development in a consistent manner that way.
That was your second bullet up there, so that state agencies
looking
at that.
We will have to consider that. That is a requirement that by 2015, it's likely to be later than that, but that we begin transitioning our vehicles to biofuel or electric or hybrid use. And that is something out of the legislature. And then the final one there is relates back to the first one, 7235020 set statewide greenhouse gas reduction goals, and that was directed at state agencies, but the legislature in 2010, effective December 1st, 2011, set a policy that our own transportation and land use policies need to ensure that we're implementing those statewide greenhouse gas reduction goals. So the goals don't apply to us directly, it's not a mandate. But how we're operating, how we're developing, has to be consistent with that. So beyond the sticks, the government requirements, just the overall ethic of being in an absolutely beautiful area in North Bend, and valuing that, wanting to make sure that our children have the same beauty around us that we can enjoy. The third factor is being ready. The early bird gets the worm. So change will happen. Climate change is happening. The price of oil, electricity, water will inevitably rise, and that will have an impact on the city's budget. So if we adapt ourselves ahead of time, we're more prepared for when those costs increase. And then just getting back to how do we want to apply this in North Bend, this has to be simple. It has to be something that a small city can do. It has to be something that is not an undue burden on developers or the or private landowners. So what I wanted to begin with in this workshop is basically conservation of resources, so fossil fuel use, water use, and electrical energy use. And the following workshops will touch on other matters like waste reduction, recycling, and eventually greenhouse gas reduction. I do want to say this is a workshop, and I don't want to just continue to ramble on. I want it to be a conversation, so please interrupt me at any time.
You're doing a great job.
Yeah.
I'm Larry Costello. Appreciate the opportunity to participate in this evening. Just a procedural question. Comments and questions that are raised by the public here tonight, how are those going to be captured and recorded and then acted on going forward so that we know how this includes?
Yeah, first of all, we are on tape, so any comments that you have, we'll have on the record, and that's available on the city's website. Every Planning Commission meeting, the audio and minutes are prepared. And then second of all, certainly try to take notes and make sure that your comments are heard and considered.
Yeah. And in regard to overall procedure, as a workshop, our goal here tonight is not to stick to a typical three-minute comment time. We want it to be an interactive session. I want to make sure that everyone has an opportunity. Of course, we've got a pretty small group tonight, so that ought to lend well to it. But sometimes when we get very large groups, we do a little more strong meeting management. But with the team that we've got here tonight, I think it would be pretty free flowing. We do want to make sure that we capture participants' full names and addresses so that we know for the record, you know, that who's spoken. That's very important.
Do you like me to repeat?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Mary Costello, 13050 470th Avenue, Southeast, North Bend, 98045.
Thanks. So to start off with fossil fuel use and conservation.
I apologize. I don't mean to be a problem there. I know that you were wanting to concentrate on those three aspects of the plan, the new chapter. Is there going to be an opportunity? I would like to comment on the introductory information.
Sure.
That has kind of set the table for what's happening here. You gave us the introduction on the PowerPoint, but in the written text, which I have read the narrative completely, if it's okay, I'd just like to offer some comments and observations that I would make. In my opinion, how it's been presented, there's a very strong bias toward sustainability and such. A bias, in my opinion, that I would question whether it is appropriate. For instance, there's a certain degree of admonishment that is being presented there with regards to the habits and behaviors of the United States in general, and we the people, effectively. And there was reference to we represent 5% of the global population, consume 25% of various fossil fuel resources. And I'm not disputing that those are that's fact. However, what's not represented there is the United States also represents 25% of the world's gross domestic product. So the entire economy of the world, we represent 25% of that. We export $2 trillion out of this economy to other parts of the world. We import $2.5 trillion. All of those trade activities represent jobs and consumption by other people throughout the world. Mm-hmm. So these are very important dynamics that, are not being captured here in the front end of this. So, again, I felt that there was a real admonishment taking place of the United States without fairly, in a balanced way, examining the other aspects of the United States. United States in terms of the great contributions that we're making. Wherever we go, wherever our capitalistic form of society touches, we bring value and we bring improvement and we bring great progress to other cultures and places throughout the world, in spite of the many things that we see that are complicated in the world as well. So I guess I'm just suggesting and asking that as a public policy document, that if we present something like this, that it be fair and balanced. Right now, I don't feel that it's fair and balanced. And additionally, the front end also includes references to the Brundtland Report 1983, which you used to define the definition of sustainability. Is the commission familiar with who Bill Harlan Brundtland is?
I don't know it, other than that was the...
I do have a little bit of information. Bill Harlan Brundtland was the Prime Minister of Norway. He was commissioned by the United Nations to prepare this Brundtland Report in 1983. It was published in 1987. She was also the Vice President of the World Socialist Party. She comes with a very unique perspective on society and world issues. The definition of sustainability that came out of that work from the United Nations, I think is, it's a very poignant statement, clearly. One thing that I think is also important to look at, though, perhaps the biggest offender of that statement is government itself. And I don't mean in the context of how many tons of CO2 gas is emitted and how many reams of paper are used as such. It's the amount of money is taken to support government now is very much unsustainable, I think, as we all see, our $15 trillion national debt and such. And that, I think, correlates to, as we create more policy, more regulation, and we put more imposition on the private sector and the wealth-creating components of our economy, and like you did refer to that, I think, in a very appropriate way, where you're looking to not become a burdensome process here by creating new policy that would hinder development and so forth. And I think that's very good. I'm very pleased to hear that. I would like to suggest that we offer more of that in the front end introductory as well. Again, looking for that balance, because the sustainability aspect of government itself is basically not there. It's putting so much burden on the wealth-creating private sector from which government subsists off of the taxes derived from the private sector in its entirety. So I think we have to just be, careful about how we present this thing, again, with a fair and balanced approach is what I'm looking for.
Yeah, you bring up some very good points, and I do want to mention that we focused on two aspects in this entire element. So first of all, city operations, what is it we're doing on our own? How are we operating our wastewater treatment plant, our park operations, our infrastructure, and so forth? And then, how are we relating to the development community? And I think everything that we're putting into the element on the development community is an incentive-based direction. So what is it that if we want to see green buildings happen, if we want to see low-impact development infrastructure, how can we incentivize that so that the development community wants to do it, rather than just kind of putting our fists down through, you're going to do this.
Right. And I think that's a very important and valuable approach. What is the form of the incentivization, however, I think is an important thing as this moves along further in terms of how that takes form. Mm-hmm. An incentive, in some respect, can be called an incentive, but it can also be a manipulation of the free market. And I think it's important that we let the markets do what the markets do best. And I can point to solar cells and solar voltaic power production. We all know the Solyndra story. We all know the NR1 story. And we all know the half a dozen other of the green companies.
Barry, I think we also know the story of our support of oil and our use of our military to derive and keep our oil prices down low so that other more sustainable practices don't have a chance. So. I appreciate your viewpoint, but when we're talking about the balance, let's make sure that we're recognizing the full spectrum.
You're right. Subsidies to the oil industry, honestly, from a free market standpoint, I don't condone those any more than I would condone subsidizing any of the other alternative energy industries that are starting to occur in Iowa. So your point is well taken.
So, So you support the general concept here of Chapter 10 of having an energy and sustainability element. Is that?
Actually, I don't know that I do support it in its entirety. I think that why are we even doing this? August 2nd of last year, the ordinance was passed, which led to this because the city was competing for Public Works Trust Fund grant money. They had a deadline of August 4th, as I understand the historical timeline. So there was a certain race against the clock to get there in order to be able to have an application in play. I think it was for some water control and some water main work, I think.
That was part of it. And that was an early action. So we were showing those agencies who were directed by the legislature to make sure that we have these policies in place that, yes, we're working on this here, some early actions, but those policies and that ordinance aren't going to stand up as permanent things. What we need to show those agencies is that we have them in our comprehensive plan as permanent policies that then inform our development regulations, our operations, and so forth. So that was just an early action, but we do need to follow through with the development of the rest of it.
But my understanding also was in the context of the application, as you pointed out also, Mike, the RCW requires demonstrating compliance with the greenhouse gas reduction goals. Limits that the state has implemented. That's really the only necessary expectation in order to qualify for the application for the grant. It seems reasonable to ask the question, how much further beyond that should we be going? How much more policy should be created in the spirit of the sustainability aspect beyond what was absolutely necessary for the application? Yeah, it looks like the current draft is far reaching beyond just the greenhouse gas component.
And that's something that the public will have to consider of what is appropriate to our situation and our context.
And I guess as one voice of the public, I would like to suggest that less is more in this case, simply because the overburdensome regulatory policy making process, as I said earlier, is really becoming a great imposition on the private sector. The free market processes that really allow economies and communities to prosper.
So have a look at the draft that we have on the city's website. And again, I think everything that we're showing as the relationship to the development community is much more an incentive basis. So we're not, again, trying to just require and force through any kind of agenda. There are things certainly that are good to do in light of sustainability in terms of our impact on the environment, our future economy, our children, but there's ways to get there that aren't just through regulations. And that's what we want to explore. So.
Thanks.
So on fossil fuel, I think with each of these...
Yeah. I just wanted to see where you want to go.
With each of these particular topics with the workshop, we want to take a step back and say what are the larger issues at hand here, globally, locally, how are other jurisdictions responding to these issues, agencies and so forth, and then I wanted to provide the actual draft policies that address the particular issue and have some discussion on that. So for fossil fuel, I think most people are familiar with the idea of peak oil, which is when production of petroleum is at its maximum point, after which the supply of new discoveries is not keeping up with the rate of production. So there's a lot of speculation as to what point peak oil is actually going to occur, but in general, most experts agree that it's either now or it's within the next 10 years. So when you think about global demand and peak oil together, it comes back to that symbol of economics 101 of supply plus demand. Increased demand, decreased supply equals considerable cost increase. And that's not going to affect just the price of fueling up our vehicles. It's going to increase the price of paving streets with asphalt, it's going to increase the cost of all the products that we buy, all the products that a municipality as a organization relies on in preparing its budgets. So it's has considerable ripple effects to the economy. The one other thing was the greenhouse gas emissions, and we'll come back to this at a later workshop, but it just does relate to fossil fuel, and that transportation and the burning of fossil fuel is the number one source by far of greenhouse gas emissions. So state requirements on fossil fuel use. The first one is the electrification requirement that we mentioned earlier, that we are preparing for more electric vehicles on the market, and we want to make sure that we're ready for them with allowing the private sector to come in with electric vehicle infrastructure. And the other one with the alternative fuel requirement from the state legislature, that we begin transitioning our municipal vehicles, our heavy trucks, our little city cars and so forth, to alternative fuel sources.
Mike, how long does the city keep those vehicles in use generally?
Well, this doesn't mean that you're going to have to just go out and replace whatever you've got. It's when you do replace it that you need to.
So they get like 10 years or 15 years max?
I don't know if they'll put a sunset on it. I would suppose that it's just when you go to replace it.
Would there be conversion? If you're talking about diesel for the tractors, for instance, you can switch over to biodiesel generally without any change whatsoever, depending on the year.
Yeah.
You have to change out some of the fittings.
And the Department of Commerce is going to prepare some rules that carry out this legislative mandate to explain to governments how is this transition supposed to occur. So those will be worked out. And that's by June 1st, 2015, when their commerce is supposed to come up with those rules.
Do we have any idea what just that aspect is in across the city, like general ballpark? And do we?
Yeah, good.
I mean,
it's a good equation that I have in the workshop here.
Okay.
So I've got an example coming up.
Just like
that
the
one.
Dollar signs are just spinning right now.
But it's again when replacement is necessary.
Right.
Rather than a requirement to just
but,
go out and replace
spending
something that's working.
$50,000 on a big truck versus something to cost
$100,000. Yeah. But that comes from the legislature, so that's not something that we as a local.
No, I know we can't. So, I mean, one of the goals was to be, you know, make it smart and simple and,
yeah.
You know, think about the economics of it. So we need to start thinking about the economics now if that is a mandate.
Yeah.
I think I've seen a park struck in somewhere about some North Cambodia. It had to be in the 1970s era. Anybody else seen that pickup truck?
And so that is
it's a part of a joke, but at the same time, I'm thinking
that is a very important aspect of sustainability.
Replacing that,
yeah.
You know, that vehicle that's putting out a lot of emissions, replacing that exponential. Expense.
Yeah,
that's not the dance.
But at the same time, as an example, we have a 1989 Chevrolet Cavalier as our vehicle for the Community Development Office. It's relatively fuel efficient. It's really ugly and beat up, but it's a very sustainable vehicle in that it's paid for. It doesn't cost
right.
much to own and operate.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's another aspect of sustainability.
Yeah, exactly.
So economic adaptation is another thing that we need to be thinking about with fossil fuel use, with the future costs of oil. So how wide our roads are determines how much paving and repaving we're going to have to do over time. And if oil is an expensive commodity, a wider road means that we're going to have to spend a lot more on maintenance than a narrower road. And then just long-term changes in our land use patterns are likely to occur. If fossil fuel costs are more expensive, people are likely to have different housing choices, maybe can start to consider transportation alternatives. So just things that we need to be thinking about. So when it comes to conservation of fossil fuel use, the principal factor has nothing to do with the city or any policies that we have or our own operations. It's the individual decisions of the members of our community. So what vehicles we buy, what the fuel economy of those vehicles are, where we travel, how we travel, how many goods we buy, that's the principal driver of our fossil fuel use. So we're not going to get involved in that at all. We don't want to establish any policies telling people how to live their lives. However, there are a lot of things that are secondary factors that we are involved in. What's that?
Sorry, I couldn't help myself. In response to your comment, we're not going to get any people lives into the feds will.
So how our community is laid out can have a big impact on how people use their vehicles, whether or not they choose to use a car, or if they want to use a bicycle or walk to their destination. So that's why we feel like complete streets are very important. Complete streets being having adequate sidewalks, having bicycle lanes, having an interconnected grid network, as opposed to a super arterial and cul-de-sac pattern that forces people to drive long distances to get a short air mile distance. And then this is maybe somewhere where our code could come in, where there are some requirements on the development world in terms of providing bicycle parking. Currently, we require a certain amount of auto parking, but don't do anything about making sure that the development communities have commercial businesses anyway are providing bicycle parking. So that can be as simple as making sure there's bike racks in the front of the store, or for larger businesses, opportunities such as covered bicycle parking or bicycle lockers, so that it is a viable means of transportation when you get to the destination.
Excuse me, what are VMTs?
Oh, vehicle miles traveled. So when we live at higher densities overall, we're having to travel less within the community.
Mike, on the densities, I kind of have an issue where we don't balance that out with increased densities, reliance on stormwater systems and sewer systems and wastewater treatment plants versus larger lots where there's natural water absorption rates and green space.
Lower densities are much more costly to cities because you're having to build that much more pipe and that much more roadway, which is more impervious surface to treat. The low-impact development aspect, infiltrating stormwater, I think is a wonderful thing to achieve wherever possible, and there's increasing means of doing that within high densities too. The city of Portland has retrofitted a number of their streets so that the streets don't drain to the stormwater system anymore, but handle it within very intense biofiltration slopes. And then again, city operations, where we have policies, not policies for the community, but policies on how we're operating as an agency, as an organization. Some things that other cities around here are doing, there's the Evergreen Fleets Initiative, which has as members King County, Snohomish County, 21 Puget Sound cities, and then a number of private fleet operators as well. I think Boeing is a member, Microsoft is a member, and what it is a commitment to right-sizing your vehicles to make sure that if you need a little runabout to do your business's errands, that you're not buying a Ford Expedition to do that or whatnot, and then for when you replace your vehicle, you make sure to replace it with something more fuel efficient. Other cities are also doing bicycle police patrolling. A number of cities are doing that not just for not as a method of saving fuel or saving costs, but as a way to increase relationship to the community. So it's easier to patrol certain areas on bicycles than it is on vehicle. And we have a good example with the Snoqualmie Valley Trail. That would be very easy to patrol with a bicycle. And then just again, internal policies about how our employees have options to use alternative transportation and alternative work schedules to reduce overall commuting needs. So back to the example of a vehicle. So right behind us out the window there, you can see our City Hall vehicle is a 1998 Ford Expedition. It gets 12 miles per gallon city driving. It's used almost exclusively in city. so basically 12 miles per gallon. So when, you can see I highlighted in red, when replacement is necessary. And in this case, I didn't use a hybrid vehicle because it's, or an electric vehicle, because the gas mileage is not an easy comparison to do. So I compared just a simple non-hybrid Ford Focus, which would get 28 miles per gallon city, 40 highway. So assuming we use about 6,000 miles per year with our city vehicles, we would save almost $1,000 annually based on $4 a gallon gas. We're already up over $4 a gallon now. And then also emit 4,940 fewer pounds of carbon dioxide.
So with that,
post office.
Post office.
And so similar things like that to go out to a development site or
so
local errands.
So there's no need for off-roading. There's no real hauling being done with it, so
no.
To speak. So we've got an oversized vehicle from the get-go.
Yeah.
Oh, what year, I'm sorry?
1998. So it's in good condition still. There's no need to replace it at this time. But when we do go to replace it, we should be thinking about, is this the right vehicle for what our needs are?
It was cheap to buy. It was $2 gas tank.
Mm-hmm.
Probably was a no-brainer at the time.
So these are just factors of sustainability that don't involve any kind of imposition on the community, but it's just thinking, are we making the right decision? So what are we doing currently with fossil fuel use? Our street standards require an interconnected development so that we are getting the ability for people to walk and bicycle easily. We don't currently have any policies addressing direct fossil fuel use, such as vehicle purchase considerations or anti-idling policies. We might be able to implement a policy that says if you're not driving the vehicle, it doesn't need to be left running to keep the heat on or whatnot. And we don't currently require bicycle parking.
There was quite a review here recently on the idling policy. I didn't participate in that, but I saw snippets in the paper from time to time. I thought that there was an exception for the public vehicles on the idling policy.
There was, and I didn't understand that. I wasn't a part of that workshop.
Obviously, it's something counter to what you're suggesting here.
Yeah, it is. And
referring to the council.
Yeah. I want to understand that more.
Yeah, there was an exception. I don't remember the exact verbiage of what limits were, but generally, you know, the truckers certainly were being targeted. You know, I don't want to say targeted, but that was the fault. There was the exception of the public vehicles.
Yeah, and I imagine there's some necessity in circumstances, and we don't want to interfere with that. But what we want to do is keep convenience idling from happening.
To public safety plans would be first guess.
There wasn't. I remember public safety vehicles.
But I don't remember if there was generally. I don't remember it specifically saying anything about the other public vehicles not having some kind of idling. But then again, that whole thing was just kind of, in my mind, was lots of stuff put on a paper, and not. I think you could find lots of discrepancies around. It was definitely draft.
Yeah, that was the first stage of exploring that issue.
So, Mike, I wanted to go back up and just ask a question about the paving. Is there any difference in paving materials? I don't know, recycled rubber versus, you know, asphalt, traditional asphalt. Are there different ways we can implement standards for street construction that are going to be better?
Yeah, there certainly are alternatives coming out of the market. Pervious asphalt uses less asphalt overall because it's porous. Concrete is probably going to become cheaper over time than asphalt because it doesn't involve the oil.
So would those be more based in code rather than in our plan, right?
We have street standards that specify material and thickness right now. Those might not be something that we want to amend at this point because we're just looking at policies. So as long as we have policy support,
well, I could see a shift where we're more writing code to match the intended outcome than then the particular material for the skin, I'm sure we're using, you know, 4 or 2 asphalt lays, right? And instead of that, but what that's designed to get at is the gross vehicle weight that it supports, yeah. Right? So you may end up writing code that's more talking yeah. about gross vehicle weight instead of what's the thickness of the asphalt. This might not be about asphalt. Right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So these are the policies that are in the draft, and I just wanted to give an opportunity, so we don't have to go through every one of them, but give an opportunity for any comment on what you see there, or if there's anything that you feel we're missing or that we shouldn't be including.
Is there anybody in the city who wants to work from home instead of coming in and seeing all the smart places?
The transportation element, we had separate paragraph around the support of that, right? So we want to make sure that they're compatible in the way that it speaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Certainly speaking to it in this element, allowing.
There may be more on the next page.
Nope. Mike, what is the heating source for the city vehicles, including the operations center?
For the city vehicles or the
buildings?
The buildings. Natural gas for our building. This is also natural gas. So this is probably an example where we have a pretty inefficient system in building that.
Say, Mike, on 7.4, prohibit items in certain circumstances and locations. Yes. Do you have any examples of what you have in mind there?
Well, that probably was when we developed that originally, we were probably thinking about certain truck town, you know, truck town, schools,
nursing homes, daycare centers, children breathe twice a week.
Throughout all of these policies, though, we try to keep policies relatively broad and vague so that we're not pigeonholing ourselves. What we'll go back, what we'll do with all of this element is go back with an action plan that further considers how we're going to implement some of these things. So some of them may become different regulations. Some of them are again, programs directed at our own operations that will get flushed out through the action plan that then later carries out the policies.
I think my comment to 7.4 is I think you're talking about two different things in the clauses.
Yeah.
It feels like they should be separated and become standalone. I mean, one is about educating and the other is about
okay.
policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can separate that out.
And 7.1, I support the idea of what you're trying to get at. Kind of going back to the comment I was making about the vehicle currently in use versus what you're looking at, should part of that decision-making process be about appropriate matching use to
yeah.
need, right? So it happens to be this city administrator really likes a big SUV. This one happens to really like a... What is the really need, you know, what is the application for if it's a vehicle for the vehicle?
The 80% use versus the 20% occasional.
Yeah. I mean it may be that a particular use it's not gonna be a fuel efficient vehicle if that's what the use requires.
Yeah.
I don't know what that would be, but
yeah, certainly some of our vehicles out in public works that the need is capacity.
You're not going to give them a Prius to haul rock.
Right.
I think that's a great use for a Prius.
Okay. Shall we go on to water? Okay, so the broad trends, again, is decreased snowpack over time. So I think the University of Washington has put out some estimates of 1/3 reduction with within 30 years of our snowpack, which is pretty significant when you think about where our water comes from. We rely almost entirely on snowpack to refill our aquifers and our reservoirs. So that will have a big impact on the cost of water around here. On top of that, we've got in-stream flow protection requirements. So we've got the Chinook salmon, which is an endangered species, bull trout, a number of other species that are dependent on the certain levels of flow within the low flow months. And as a result, we're required, or the state requires, maintaining that minimum flow.
So Mike, I have a question there. I'll go back to my radical idea. Who owns the excess water in the winter flows when it's really high, and why can't we stick a hose in there, capture some of that water in a reservoir, and then use that either for our summertime months where we don't need to offset and pay for water usage, or what is it? Population growth is something like for every one person today, 3 people in 10 years. So we could use that as a commodity, as a city-owned resource, or as a water utility resource to market. So who owns it? How do we find out that, you know, can we actually think about that? And does it make sense?
What reservoir?
Build one.
Yep. I mean,
builders.
The price of water for what's available.
Because snowpack is especially high this year, which is...
So you're talking about a dam, then?
No, I'm saying, pump it into groundwater sources, build a pool. I don't know. I'm not an expert in that area. I'm just saying, should we look at that?
That's an interesting idea.
I know that we would save downstream flooding if we could take out a certain amount of water. I just don't know if we have rights to it and how we go about that.
Yeah, we have a certain prescribed right from the State Department of Ecology. As this, every jurisdiction and every property owner, we're under Western Water Law, which basically means that somebody owns all water. It's not free for the taking. So if you want to increase your water draw, you're taking it from the state or from somebody else.
Yeah, but to Gary's point, it'd be a long, arduous negotiation, but conceptually, I understand what you're saying, which is if you've got a theoretic abundance,
you get it high enough where it's going to result in flooding, why can't you take off some of that and lessen the flooding and capture it?
Yeah. It's more about the how you capture it. Mm-hmm.
And that'll let experts.
Let's go.
Drill a hole, put it in groundwater. I don't know. Got it.
Storm balls. All of the levees.
So the broad picture of all that together is that water, like oil, is going to become eventually a much more scarce resource, which will drive up our costs and force us to think about conservation. So what are we doing right now in North Bend? We've got our landscape standards do require a certain native and drought-tolerant content, and that helps reduce the need for irrigation. Our fire station, as an example, much exceeds that, 100% drought-tolerant species. We have a low-impact demonstration project, which the applicants are coming in now for to develop across the freeway. And that's going to be done in a manner that really retains a lot of existing vegetation and minimizes clearing for the buildings so that stormwater can be infiltrated on site, help to decrease runoff to the rivers and decrease water use.
Mike, what is the, or are there any requirements around the open space areas?
Open space areas in general?
65% of the site retained as open space. Are there any requirements for use or limited use or...
That requirement was intended principally to protect the upper slopes. The site sits adjacent to forest or woods.
So they're more like a native growth protection?
Yeah. With a series of wetlands there.
They're not park and playground?
No. It would be natural forest. Our 2010, or our water system plan is where most of our policies addressing water use and water conservation are found. and it's got a goal to reduce system leakages as the principal means of reducing waste, and then also to reduce per capita income. And we've got education on our city's website about how to detect leaks, how to reduce your water use through installing more efficient faucets and shower heads and so forth.
How often does the city wash its vehicles?
I think our Cavalier was washed about 3 years ago.
Observation would say that often.
Yeah. It's actually, it's a white car, but there's green parts of it. So options, things that we're not currently doing. We don't prescribe for ourselves any means of how we're maintaining our public lands. So it's possible to, as we move forward with future parks and so forth, to use more native landscaping, reduced lawn area except for where it's a true play area, and xeriscaping, which is just landscaping without any irrigation with species that can handle that.
The idea of native landscaping is built on what presumption?
That it survives better on its own, and that it's also more compatible with the surrounding wildlife.
So is it, right, it's driven partly on the idea that it's more adaptable to the local climate?
Yeah, it doesn't need many inputs from fertilizers, from watering, pruning, care.
Is there any evaluation that you're aware of on non-natives as far as being as like or better?
Yeah, there's many. Non-natives, like the strawberry bush is a non-native, but it's used readily for drought-tolerant landscaping in this area because it's adapted to this climate and it's beautiful. There's a lot of things like that.
Just striking in that we spent a lot of time focusing on the native plantings, and are we doing that in some respects at the detriment of things that might even be better in some respects?
And our code asks for only 50% native, so that's still a lot of opportunity for those other things. We also don't do any sort of incentives right now for any water-saving features, so that's a potential option to explore in the future. Most of the cities in our region are a part of either the Cascade Water Alliance or the Saving Water Partnership, and those two organizations or alliances offer programs for rebates. So replacing shower heads, replacing toilets will give you a pretty substantial rebate, and that's based on the fact that that reduction in water means that they're having to go after less new sources, which is less costly in the long run. So that's, because we're not a part of one of those alliances, we don't have the economies of scale likely to do fairly substantial rebates, but it's something to think about in the future.
I assume there's a cost to be part of the alliance, for the city to be part of the alliance, or?
We would have to have tie-ins to their water system, so it's probably not very feasible for us in our remote location.
You sell that water.
Okay, see?
But with Snoqualmie, we could eventually tie into their system, we are already tied into Salo's system, and between the three of those, maybe there's opportunities for those kinds of programs. Also, standards for new development, standards and incentives. EPA has got their Water Sense Efficiency Standard, which is kind of the equivalent of the Energy Saver, not Energy Saver, what they call it, Energy Star, where it's a rated product that says that this is so many percentage, such percentage higher efficient with water use than other competing products.
Do you know if the car wash in town is recycled water?
I don't know.
That's kind of, it's on a similar thought pattern there, but again, too, of the traditional car wash versus the waterless wash, such as the Twin Star.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean, it'd be interesting to know the cost-benefit ratio of that environmentally.
Mm-hmm. something earlier from the mine, Cadman Mine installed a truck wash that recycles, I think, 80 to 90% of its water, and filters out all the dust and puts it back in the mine for later use.
On to energy use. Did I not put the policies? Oh, I don't have policies in that section because all of our policies are found in back in that water system plan. And those are the two goals right there. So if we were to do policies, we would have to think of what is that water system plan not addressing that we would want to address. And my personal suggestion is if we want to address additional issues, that the water system plan address the issues so we keep it, use the right tool for the right function.
Right.
Yeah.
Isn't there a big underground water, a lake by the high school or something?
We have a reservoir under much of the Snoqualmie Valley that the city draws as one of its sources of water.
Is it the largest aquifer in King County is underneath us?
I don't know. Quite possibly, because the Snoqualmie Falls is there because of a large bedrock intrusion. And so that same bedrock is what creates the bathtub of the valley. So that's why the aquifer is very large and deep.
So that's future need?
Yeah. But that future need is still fed by the same snowpack that feeds just about everybody else. So if that snowpack dries up, that aquifer is likely to. So again, with energy, like the other water issue, the decreased snowpack means less water for where we get most of our power from, hydropower. We know that demand is continuing to increase as population grows, and we've become much more efficient over time with our use of electricity, but even given that efficiency gain, we're still using the same amount of energy overall as we have for 40 years because we're just plugging in so much more. We've got bigger houses. We're using a lot more products than what we used to. And then also electric vehicles, even though they're good for many aspects of the environment, they're going to be a big draw for electricity over time. So it just shows again, back to economics, when demand goes up, price also goes up.
Is there any where in this energy conversation that we're actually understanding truly where the energy, electricity specifically, comes from? Bonneville Power, Puget Sound Energy, they're all sharing water and transfers. The origin of the electricity.
On their website, Puget Sound Energy does list its sources and percentages of where the power comes from. So it is a part of the regional network. They draw from sources in Idaho and Oregon. So it's, but I think the majority is hydropower in our area.
I just, this discussion, every time it comes up, when the average citizen considers, I'd like to drive, you know, an electric vehicle, it's not a Tesla. They're doing it because they're trying to do the right thing. If the energy they're using to charge their battery is actually coming from a coal factory, they'd probably want to know that.
Yep.
So if we're going to create these devices in the city, sponsor them, or allow them, it seems like a good time to ask that question.
Yeah, PSC does.
Document, know where the electricity that we're using actually comes from.
Yeah,
even if it's a trade or a swap.
Go to their website because they do break it down by source.
Okay.
Tanner, how many electric vehicles are in the valley at this time? Does anybody know that?
Every vehicle manufacturer, every one of them, is currently offering or developing an electric vehicle for the private market. So it's.
The Chevy Volt is on hold because one is buying it.
This month was a record month for this.
They sold 20. It was a 100% increase.
I just was curious. In our valley, do we have any owners that are running on pure electric?
I've seen them.
Yeah, I know there's at least one in our neighborhood. There would be two.
My dad is very conservative, and he's right now considering a Nissan Leaf. So it's a changing market. It's just we as a city want to be ready for when those changes occur.
I'm just looking at what cost of whether it's electric bill or just gas in the tank. I don't think you're getting expensive. So one way to save money is just to get more fuel efficient. Gasoline still has the highest energy density of all subsidized supplies.
Subsidized.
Not nearly as much as the electric vehicle.
So, in terms of increased demand for energy, Puget Sound Energy and the other power providers find that it's much less expensive to their operations to increase conservation of its users than it is to find new sources of electricity. So PSC has a considerable number of programs to encourage conservation. So as a city, we don't really want to get into how people use energy because that's handled by the private market, by Puget Sound Energy, by Tanner Electric, other cooperatives. And we want to direct our citizens to the information and the programs that they're offering and not try to create any programs ourselves because that's a little beyond our scope of what we need to do here. However, we do have in our own operations opportunities to reduce our own power use as an agency. So what are we doing currently? We, in our utilities element, we have a number of policies that talk about conservation. Another opportunity that we currently are not addressing is, or another thing that we don't require is street lights in subdivisions. So we leave that up to the developer to provide lighting as they see fit. It's an opportunity to preserve our dark sky and then also to reduce consumption overall. We don't have any programs or requirements internally, though, to implement conservation through our practices.
So, Mike, LED bulbs versus CFL bulbs. I've had CFL bulbs that last about the same as a regular traditional bulb. I'm trying an LED bulb. It's a lot more expensive, but it's a lot less in energy. So I haven't had a chance to look at other cities who have adopted it, namely Los Angeles has the longest history, I think, is what I wanted to look at. Is there any research out there that says that these are actually proven now and a better way to go to reduce energy usage?
I don't know about the research, but I know that a lot of cities are converting all of their stoplights to LEDs now. And Portland did it, replaced all of their LEDs, and it's actually saving. It's a huge amount of money each year.
Actually, that is one of the call-outs.
Yeah.
I was going to come in and say, so we replaced our bulbs, our whole street light.
We only have one street stoplight, and it's not our own.
It's not ours.
It's the highways.
We don't own it.
Yeah.
The same's happening with the street lights as well, but right now the LEDs they're getting closer to putting out the same type of, I guess, illumination as the HBS and middle highlight. But they're not quite there yet, and so what we're finding is some of the design for private developments, like, for example, in Bothell, they're switching to some LED standards for street lights, but you're needing to space things like 100 feet apart rather than 200 feet. So the infrastructure costs are still a lot higher. But working with the vendors and stuff, the LEDs have made a big stride in just even the last couple of years. And so it won't be long, I don't think, before they start meeting those. And so
that's what's interesting. That's why Jens, Mike, and I had, I don't know, a couple of months ago, I was talking about Ballarat over here and, you know, the lighting. Mm-hmm. And I was talking about the new, you know, stretch going down North Bend Way, you know, west, and how it draws your eye there finally, you know, the new lighting.
Down here, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's, you know, that's great commercially that you finally actually realize there was something west of 202. But then on the other hand, I say, well, here we are spending all of our time talking about conservation and how we're going to get at this. It's really not getting us where we want to go, to, you know, flooding it with light like that. So maybe the distance between and lower lighting levels isn't really all that bad. And how much light do you really need? That's the question. I thought you made a comment about
that. The CFLs didn't seem to get that.
I didn't seem to get the difference of use versus traditional. Again, 2 years versus 2 years, I think I got about the same.
That's actually amazed. It's one of these things that kind of you realize over time. The home I'm in now, I purchased in 2003. First thing I did was I went out and I bought all CFLs for every figure. You know, a home full of can lights and globe lights and everything. Just this last year, I started replacing bulbs. And as I realized that through times, I was amazed, you know, because I didn't buy the 5 to 7 year light, but so that's 7, 8, 9 years on average of those bulbs. And it was interesting. I didn't think about it at the time, but you know, it became an interesting experiment because I literally replaced every bulb on day one.
And I would say I don't think they're always consistent. Maybe it's different brand.
Yeah, she does go out right away.
They're definitely
within a year. Me too.
Similar to your story, when we built our house in '86, we put in metal halide cans, and 16 years later, we still have.
That's
pretty
good life.
Yeah.
That's
another
So some things that we could consider for our own operations, Puget Sound Energy and most other Tanner Electric has the same thing. I think just about every provider has a green power program. And what that is even though those agencies, like Puget Sound Energy, sources all of its power from many sources. If you apply your power through the Green Power Program, you're ensuring that the money that you're spending is only going to the development of renewable energy sources. So hydropower, wind power, and not to natural gas or coal-fired that have more of the emissions. Issues. So Bellingham, as an example, uses 100% of its power purchases as green power. So it does cost more for the city, so it is something that the city would have to consider as a policy issue, but it's a way to reduce your impact. Also energy efficiency standards. So if we're buying a whole bunch of new equipment, new computers, printers or whatnot, many cities will have a preferable purchasing ordinance that says if it's the comparable price, you should go with the Energy Star rated equipment. Also, LEED standards. LEED stands for Leadership in Energy Efficient Design, and it's a rating system that evaluates how efficient the building is in terms of energy use, resource use, emissions and so forth. Many cities now are also applying LEED standards to their own buildings. Usually there's some sort of threshold cost or size associated with that so that you're not just applying it willy-nilly. But it's another way to reduce your energy consumption by designing buildings that are a little more thoughtful. Community solar is another opportunity. City of Ellensburg has established a renewable energy park, and it's set up as a private investment so that people, members of the community, buy shares in the energy park and then are paid back over time through the proceeds of the energy generated by the facility. So it's not something that the city would do on our own, but it's something that we could help initiate. The city of St. Paul is very interested to do this. The YMCA would be the site, and they're currently trying to drum up some support for, is this something that we can move forward with? So that would be a valley-wide project, not just a city project. And reducing street lighting. So many times there's, like we talked about, unnecessary levels of light. A lot of cities right now, as a budget cutback issue, are turning off street lights. As an example, I did a little search, turning off street lights. Montgomery, Pennsylvania, as one example, turned off just 31 streetlights and saved $6,000 a year because of that. I looked at a number of examples. I probably got about 10 or 12 examples and averaged what the savings were. And it's about $100 to $200 a year for each streetlight that gets turned off. So that's opportunity for saving energy and saving money at the same time. So here are some of our proposed policies.
I see select fixtures. I don't know if that gets to also the bulb of the, so certain fixtures would use or draw more power by their design or by their reflectivity, mm-hmm. but also the bulb energy use.
Yeah, we can certainly add in bulbs to that.
I don't know a better word to use.
Bulb fixture dominates the whole.
Mm-hmm. Fixture can be reflective or non-reflective, and therefore give off more light.
Mm-hmm. Like the LED usually operate less wattage, but give off the same.
Go on to the next page. There's the rest. No, these are directly from the draft.
Mike, can you explain a little more on Energy Star certified homes? Sorry.
Yeah, Energy Star doesn't just certify appliances and computers and so forth. But they have a program that rates homes' energy efficiency. And just like the LEED program or Built Green, you achieve a certain level of points by implementing different measures.
So that's going to go to insulation and different construction materials. Mm-hmm.
So those incentives is something that we'd have to work through with the follow-up action plan. And, so that would be perhaps some of our impact fees, reduction in impact fees if you meet one of these rating systems. Other ways, perhaps density bonuses, developers could get a higher level of density on their site if they use some of these things. There's a lot of different ways to incentivize, and that's something that the city would have to consider.
I know, what was it, the Z Homes, they did thermal heating?
Yeah.
Was it geothermal? One of the things in our weather patterns is the consistent 40-something degrees that we have make heat pumps very effective. How do we put something in that case where my neighbor buys one 500-gallon tank of propane for every three that I buy? You know, and that's the difference of having a heat pump. So obviously it's going to be less of one emission and one source, but more on power, which can be a green power source. So just wondering how to put something like that in there. I get Energy Star certified homes, buildings, and plants. I don't know about heating sources or cooling sources.
Yeah.
And if that's...
But I think the nice thing about those programs is that it's an all-encompassing thing, that it's just that there's many ways to achieve it, and so we're not trying to pigeonhole how somebody builds their project, but if they are able, through that heat pump or whatever appliance, to achieve that certification, that's simpler for the city to...
I'm not finding that word, so I'll think about that. Feel better.
Thanks.
Sing them all.
That's rough.
Sorry.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, I think that's everything for tonight. Yeah.
Mike, if I could maybe just offer one closing comment from my perspective. Thank you very much for your presentation. presentation this evening. Obviously, there's been a lot of work on this together. One other comment that I've had as a general observation throughout this document is the absence of acknowledging the importance of protecting private property rights. I recognize that this particular chapter is largely focused on municipal activities, but there was some spillover into the community at large in the speak of certain land use and transportation type regulations to help move some of this policy around. And in that context, where we're into the private sector, the protection of private property rights, I think, is vitally important. And I did a word search on this chapter, and the private property rights aren't mentioned once. I did a word search on the 9 other chapters of the North Bend Comprehensive Plan. Private property rights words are not used once. I did a word search on the 1992 vision statement, which was the precursor to all of the comprehensive plans for North Bend, and private property rights are not used even once. So the complete body of policy for North Bend is absent of recognition of private property rights, which is the superior standard to which all other regulation and policy must be measured against. That is protected by our state constitution. So I offer that as a suggestion that I think in perhaps the introductory segment that I spoke of earlier, where we're looking for the balance, it might be an appropriate opportunity to speak to that. And I think as a community member, it certainly would make me feel better to know that the city is standing firmly behind the importance of private property rights. I have recently testified to the King County Council on this very issue as well. Their comprehensive plan is much more favored than North Bend's, and it's virtually absent of recognition of private property rights as well. So this is, I think, a broad issue, and a lot of citizens and residents, not only in North Bend, but throughout all of King County and elsewhere around the state, are starting to feel very concerned about overbearing policy and regulation and the impacts. I know that the King County plan in particular is very challenging out here in the rural areas, and there's just a lot of constraint on being able to do anything. Even if you have large acreage, it's virtually are at a dead stop with being able to do anything. So I'm hoping and asking North Bend to consider those issues as possible. Thank you.
Mike, most of these codes, though, they will apply to new construction, new development. They're not anything that's going to be retro on existing home.
No.
Other than opportunities or maybe benefits of a shared energy source.
Yeah, for existing residents, the principal means would be through education and encouraging them to link into existing programs.
But that's where it all starts. It's really easy to tell the new construction, these are the rules. The minute that gets to be acceptable, it goes backwards.
But that's again why we're focusing on incentives on new development rather than requirements.
Then requiring it. And I feel like when we have conversations about building standards and codes, that we talk about that a lot, about making sure like the shoreline master plan, what that was a huge topic, was making sure that we recognized people's private property rights. And
absolutely.
I feel like we plan to do a
that
job,
language
at
is
least
in our mission statement in a couple different directions. Specific. It may not say private property rights. Property rights are in there.
Yeah.
No, I agree. And I think
yeah.
Almost every time we talk about
we,
that,
yeah.
we are right where you're sitting.
Right on it, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, I do thank you very much. You brought up some very good points.
Yep.
So I think we'll look at some amendments to carry some of those ideas into the documents.
And anything else for the good of the order? Is there a motion to adjourn?
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
We're adjourned.
All right.